It's Thursday, March the 11th. You're listening to Matters of Policy and Politics, a Hoover Institution podcast devoted to governance and balance of power here in America and around the world. I'm Bill Whalen. I'm a research fellow here at the Hoover Institution, as well as the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. And I hope that my voice by now is familiar to you. That means that you have been listening to the Area 45 podcast that I've done for the past couple of years. But Area 45 is no more because there is no longer a 45th president. So we had to reboot this podcast. And so it's now Matters of Policy and Politics. So glad to have you on board and keep listening. And we'll try to keep doing our best to give you fresh content. By the way, we're not the only Hoover podcast out there. There's Econ Talk with Russ Roberts, The Grumpy Economist with John Cochran, The Libertarian with Victor Davis Hanson, The Pacific Century with Misha Oslin and John Yu, and Goodfellows with Neil Ferguson, H.R. McMaster, and John Cochran. That's the audio version of the video that I record with them every week. So if you want to subscribe, very simple, go to hoover.org, our website, click on the publications tab, then go to the podcast tab. You can subscribe to any or all of them if you want to. You can also sign up for what we call our Pod Blast, which gives you the best of each month, which I hope we make the cut. That would be one of the challenges with this new podcast. So Hoover Podcast, just one part of Ideas Defining a Free Society. My guest today, if he is still with us, having sat through my very long spiel, but he was included in it, it's my friend and colleague, John Yu. John is a visiting fellow here at the Hoover Institution and a professor at the University of California at Berkeley School of Law. He's also an author. His book, Defender-in-Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power, came out last June. John is also an expert on the United States Constitution and the many nuances of election law, which unfortunately is more than a biennial or quadrennial conversation that he and I have. And that's why he's back here again. John, welcome back to the podcast. And here we are once again, my friend, delving into election laws and constitutionality. Will it ever end?
I know. We've had to have podcasts after November 4th. I mean, to talk about how the electoral count worked. But hey, Bill, congratulations on the rename and your podcast. You inspire me to talk to Misha. Maybe we should we should rename our podcast. If things go badly, we might have to call it the Chinese Lake instead of the Pacific.
I like that. That's very clever. A serious question for you, John. If there was such a creature as a podcast 25, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, would we be having as many conversations about constitutionality? Because it seems to me when things go down in Washington and the controversial, it all leads to that one basic question. Is it constitutional?
That's a great question, Bill. And I hate to criticize my own profession. But of course, there's a huge community of people who certainly have an interest in making things legal and making things constitutional challenges. But this is actually something that goes back, you know, you're a fan of American politics and Tocqueville, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe the first great scholar about American politics from abroad predicted this. You know, you remember Tocqueville said, every major dispute in America eventually becomes a legal dispute. And he had a lot of weird reasons for it, you know, because there's no aristocracy, there's no monarchy. He said lawyers and the legal system and the rule of law are kind of like a secular religion in the United States, and on and on. But he had a lot of reasons why he thought that was true. But he observed, even back in the Jacksonian era,
right,
everything turns into a constitutional fight. But I do agree with you. It seems to be accelerating. And you're more the expert on this than I, but maybe it's the fact that in a polarized world where compromise is difficult, then you go to the institution that just has to say thumbs up or thumbs down, and that's the courts.
Yeah, it seems just kind of a very bad loop, John, because Congress and the president pass laws. The question is, are they constitutional? It works its way up the legal system, goes to the Supreme Court, which is in the middle of partisan fights based on the nomination fights. And there's really no satisfaction coming out of that. So it just seems like we can't get caught out of this trap right now, just going around and around these same basic questions of constitutionality.
Yeah, the only thing maybe that's good about it, I mean, it's what people want. I don't know if it's good for politics is that the court in a way settles things. So you're right. There is this kind of, you know, return, you know, things return back to the court over and over again, like abortion, but the only way to affect it is the appointments to the Supreme Court. And it's very rare to enact constitutional amendments. That may be actually, I don't know what you think, that may actually be bad for democracy, because if you're going to get a settlement of the issue at the court, does that maybe encourage all the participants to be as extreme as possible, to go for the biggest win possible, rather than to seek a consensus and a compromise that everyone can live with, that you never have to go to court?
That's very well put, John. So today I want to talk about two very large pieces of legislation and then one procedural question in the Senate. So let's begin with measure number one, the Federal Covert Relief Bill, a.k.a. the American Rescue Plan Act. I always love how they come up with names for these, but this is the ARPA, I guess, the American Rescue Plan Act. Here's what I'm asking.
Are you sure it's not the AARP Rescue Act?
No, sir. Well, there are a lot of members of Congress who should be an AARP, but that's another conversation for another day. So here's what I'm interested in terms of the COVID bill, John. The Senate inserted language into it, which expressly tells states that they, quote, shall not use the funds provided to either directly or indirectly offset a reduction in the net tax revenue, or do anything that, quote, reduces any tax by providing for a reduction in a rate, a rebate, a deduction, a credit, or otherwise, or delays the imposition of any tax or tax increase. So, John, long story short, the federal government is telling state governments how they can and cannot spend the money they're giving to them. Is it constitutional?
I'd say no, but this is a case of first impression because Congress has never tried anything this drastic. But it really goes back to how you read the last big expansion of federal power at the expense of the states, which was the Obamacare bill, which was essentially nationalized much of the healthcare markets in the country. This went to the Supreme Court, and this involves what we call the spending clause. So it's interesting. The court has said that, you know, Congress's powers are limited. Even the Commerce Clause, under which Congress mostly conducts its regulation of the national economy. And so the interesting thing is the court has also said, but even if something's outside the Commerce Clause, the federal government is allowed to pay states to do things for it that it couldn't do itself. And then for the first time, the court in the Obamacare case said, but there's a limit to that. So in that case, essentially the Obamacare Act paid states, but also threatened to take away Medicaid and Medicare money away from states if they did not expand the number of people who could receive money from from the Medicare Medicaid laws as expanded by Obamacare. Now, the interesting thing is it wasn't just that provision was interesting, but it was really the first time the court had ever said, no, that's unconstitutional. There is a limit to how far Congress can essentially use the federal treasury to essentially persuade, critics would say bribe, the states to do certain things for it. Right. So this provision that you've identified, Bill, is I would think it's unconstitutional because essentially it says to the states, okay, here's an enormous amount of money, you know, $1.9 trillion. If you don't agree to freeze your tax laws or to only increase taxes but not decrease taxes, we're going to take all that money away from you.
Right.
That seems to me under the Obamacare case to be unconstitutional because it's what the court there said is so much money is at stake.
Right.
The second thing I would say that's, and this is why it's really a case of first impression, is states could argue, that this is different than those past spending clause cases where, what you were doing is really sort of helping federal policy. So the classic spending clause case is Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, which are all joint federal state programs. Uh-huh. The state takes money from the federal government and then it helps implement the program and carry it out.
Right.
This is really, this is different. This is a case where the federal government is giving the states money and then saying, you don't have the power to exercise one of your core sovereign rights as a state, which is to set tax rates.
Right, John. One other way they specified spending was the bill says that states cannot deposit federal bailouts into their public pension funds, but states can use bailout money for private sector pension funds, which are .. run by labor unions. So again, is it constitutional for the federal government to tell the state you can put it into column A, but you can't put it in the column B?
Yeah, no, I think that's another good point. Like, there's nothing that says Congress can't give the money to the states to give to private pension funds, or the federal government could just directly fund private pension funds. I don't even know why I would have to go through the states. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting question. Could the state federal government say, we're going to give you a bunch of money, but you can't put it into the pension funds? It's the same. So in this case, the blue states, rather than the last question, the red states could similarly argue, well, under the Sebelius case, the Obamacare case, you are you are putting conditions on the way we use money, which risks so much money that the state really doesn't have a choice. That's the real, I should have mentioned this earlier, that's the real principle at stake, as the court has described it, is does the state really have a choice? Can it say, well, we're going to turn down the money and we're just going to do things our way? The court has said, if there's so much money at stake that the court is, the states really have no choice,
right,
then it's coercion and it's unconstitutional. If you're talking about, again, trillions, you know, $2 trillion, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe billions for some states.
Right.
And if they don't do these two things, they lose out on the money. The court might say that is coercive because it's just too much money in emergency to give up.
John, how mechanically would this work in terms of a state trying to go after the federal government and decide how to spend? Would an attorney general of a state have to sue the federal government and take it up to the federal courts?
And this is actually goes back to your excellent first question about how everything's becoming constitutionalized and legalized. One thing we saw just starting, I would say, I think triggered because of Obamacare, was the state's attorney generals started organizing across multiple states and suing en masse against federal laws they don't like. So under Obamacare, you saw a number of the Republican states and their attorney generals get together. And they actually are the ones who really brought the lawsuit, or powered the lawsuit through in the lower courts. Then under Trump, this really went into overdrive. You know, for example, I think Xavier Becerra, the attorney general of California, who's now up for confirmation to be secretary of HHS. I think he boasted he had sued the Trump administration 100 times. I mean, that's 25 a year. That's two a month. That's, you know, did the attorney general have anything else, any time to do anything else when he was here? So I expect that's going to happen again. You're going to have, and it'll be interesting because you have some Republican AGs, I think we're going to sue about this freeze on tax cuts. And then you might have the blue state AGs who are going to complain about this restriction on not being able to put money into pension funds.
What else, John, do you expect the Republican attorney generals to go after in terms of constitutional questions?
Well, there's a lot. I mean, this could bring us to H.R. 1. But one thing
we'll get to H.R. 1 in a second, but just if there's anything else just kind of looming
and
out.
So one thing they're going to complain about, I think, is just federalization. So this has been something more popular with red state than blue state attorney generals is, and again, it tests how far you can go with the spending power, not the power of direct regulation, but how far the federal government can go in paying states to do things for it.
Right.
And so you could say one thing that the COVID bailout bill, and it's one of the, again, it's like one of those bills, we got to pass it till we learn what's in it because it's so long. There's so many unrelated provisions.
And you read it. You drew credit. You actually said
parts of it. So you could say, so here's some examples. So just things that occurred to me. So one is, the bill apparently has provisions to cancel out student debt, student loan debt. So the state teachers, where did that come from? You know, is there, is this within the powers of Congress? I guess so. Are they going to charge? Are they going to have to pay taxes on the cancellation of the debt? That's usually what you have to do on your taxes. So that's, but I would say if I were state attorney general, what I would do is actually, if I were Republican, is bring a case against just the sweeping federalization of life, that this really is like the Obamacare case, something that upsets the balance of federal versus state power. That while you could defend individual provisions, what the Republican AGs are going to say is like, this is just an enormous change in the balance of power between the federal and state governments. That would be the main theme. And then pick, you know, now I will say, this is the interesting thing is it's Republicans who came up with the idea of state block grants in the first place. Right. It was a Nixon idea. And actually it was funny. So it's a funny how, you know, the politics change of this, but if I remember correctly, because that's what this COVID bill is, you could say it's just a $1.9 trillion block grant. I mean, it's an enormous block grant back to the states. I mean, it's not $1.9 trillion to the states, but a lot of it's to the states. And, you know, the criticism of block grants was, well, why are we just paying taxes to give to the federal government and then we just get it back, right? Like, what is the point of that? But Nixon, you know, it was interesting. Nixon did it because what he was trying to do was to get around the bureaucracy. Right. So Nixon wanted to turn everything into block grants to states rather than having federal programs administered for a bureaucracy in D.C. But you know, what Nixon didn't seem to care about was federalism. And I think that's the problem you're going to have here.
Okay. This is a good chance to segue now to H.R. 1, which may or may not see the light of day. And that gets us to the question of filibusters, which we'll get into as well. H.R. 1 is always significant in this regard, John. A new president comes in with a new Congress, and it's always worth seeing, especially in the party's controlled vote chambers, to see what it is that H.R. 1 is, because that's kind of a tell as to what their priority is. So George W. Bush comes to office in 2001, John, and H.R. 1 is No Child Left Behind. Bush wanted education out of the chute. 2009, Barack Obama comes in. H.R. 1 is the American Recovery Reinvestment Act, known better to most people as the Stimulus Act. So his priority, H.R. 1 in this Congress, John, is the For the People Act. Here we are with another clever name, For the People Act. It's been approved by the House on a straight party line vote. It is now headed toward the Senate. The purpose of it in the bill's law is to, quote, expand Americans' access to the ballot box, reduce the influence of big money in politics, strengthen ethics rules for public servants, and implement other anti-corruption measures for the purpose of fortifying our democracy and for other purposes. Okay, sounds fair enough. Let's go on with more of it. H.R. 1, John, seeks to increase voter turnout by expanding early voting, lessening identification requirements, allowing same-day registration, requiring states to set up automatic registration for federal elections for eligible voters. It requires states, John, to establish electronic voter registration, permit voters to register on election day. It would require states to automatically register felons once they've completed their sentences. And, John, it would expand voter access to absentee and mail-in voting, as well as set ground rules for how voters drop off their ballots, apply to vote by mail, and more. In other words, John, the federal government, which just told states how to spend their money, is now telling states how to hold their elections. So again, my friend, is it constitutional?
So again, you're asking me to push it from the realm of fact to opinion, because a lot of these are unprecedented too, unprecedented expansions of federal power. And right. In using a clause, the times, places, and manners clause, which allows basically says states run elections for Congress.
Right, but Congress does have some power here, John. So why don't you begin by explaining what their power is?
So Congress has a lot of power, but it's never used it in this way. So we don't really know what it's doing is constitutional. So my guess would be many of these provisions will be unconstitutional, but it's totally a guess based on what the court, this court, the Roberts Court, has done before. So sorry to not give you a clear yes or no. But if I had to bet my own money, I would say a lot of it would be held unconstitutional by the Roberts Court.
But maybe you think, first of all, it contradicts the principles of federalism.
Yeah. So here, for one thing, it's interesting. There's, you could say, three types of elections that we hold on November 4th. There's the presidential election, there's the congressional election, and then there's the elections for office for state and local officials. Congress has no real right to regulate state and local elections, except for basis of racial discrimination. Congress has limited power to regulate presidential elections because it's still up to the state whether to have a presidential election at all.
Right.
So most of the congressional power here has to come, most of the power for H.R. 1 really comes from the elections, the power of Congress over elections for Congress. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is, even if H.R. 1 were to pass, if states, say there were red states that disliked H.R. 1, regardless of its provisions, they could just say, okay, you want to have these requirements, some of which you mentioned, so we're only going to apply them for elections to Congress, and we're going to have three separate elections now. We're going to have one election for president where we're going to decide things. We're going to have another election for state and local officials where we're going to decide things. And then, yes, you, Congress, you could set, but you could imagine the chaos that could ensue, because states could, I think, legitimately just hold three separate sets of elections now. Mm-hmm. Right now, of course, because Congress really has never tried to interfere in any great way with the running of congressional elections, states have rolled them all three into one. Right? And so you go to vote on November 4th, you see all those elections at the same time on the same ballot. That could really change. But let me just answer directly your question, the power of Congress. So the main provision is set out in Article 1, and we basically call it the Elections Clause. And so the Elections Clause says, and this is Section 4, it says the time, places, and manner. So time, places, and manner, that's the key phrase of holding elections for senators and representatives is provided by the state legislature. But Congress may at any time by law make or alter those regulations.
Right. Right.
So you can see Congress does have a lot of power. Mm-hmm. And all, most of this power here would be over what is the word, quote unquote, manner mean? Right. Does the word manner in this clause give Congress, right, for example, as you mentioned, the right to say felons have to be able to vote? So does it give Congress the power to say not just time and place of the election, but who's allowed to vote?
Right.
Does it give Congress the power to say not just where and when, but also the districts, how the districts are drawn within which you're going to vote? Does it give Congress not just time and place, but also can Congress now say, and we're going to give money to people who are running in those elections, right? Congress has never created a financing system for congressional candidates before.
Right.
We don't know because Congress has never really done anything like this.
Okay. And then the question of manner and manner of elections, John, what does manner mean to you?
So this is here's a good example. So Congress in 1969, 68, I think, you may remember this better than me, changed the voting age to 18, right? Right. Amongst other things. And the Supreme Court in a fractured case upheld it. Now Congress said, right, that's not time, that's not place. Manner has to include the right to decide who gets to vote uh-huh. in an election. The Supreme Court fractured, and if you, it's a case called Oregon versus Mitchell from 1970. It's really more famous for other things now. There are other things that were in that case, but this was one of the issues in the case. Court couldn't really come to, and so what happened? The Constitution was amended. Right. People,
26th Amendment.
Yeah, right. People were actually not sure whether Congress could claim the quote unquote manner meant we get to decide who votes to. Mm-hmm. And so, right, for out of safety, not relying on the Supreme Court, people amended. That to me suggests, mm-hmm. At least, that Congress probably doesn't have the power to decide who gets to vote or who doesn't get to vote. What if Congress were to say not just felons? What if Congress were to say anyone can vote, not just citizens, but just right. residents can vote?
Right. And if John, if the federal government does tell the states how to run their elections, can states push back? For example, could states put in a voter ID law, for example, on top
this
of
is, it? Right. This is another thing that H.R. 1 prohibits is essentially voter ID. And so, again, I don't know if voter ID is a, it's definitely not a time and a place. That's a closer question. I mean, voter ID is a lot closer to manner, it seems right. to me. You know, how you prove who you are to vote. I think the Democrats in Congress have a maybe stronger case there, right? On the other hand, you know, this is an error. And the other reason I would say that is because similar things, you know, to me anyway, and voter ID might be closer to tests given to see whether you should be able to vote that day, which the court has said Congress can restrict, and we're restricted in the Voting Rights Act of 65. That one is a lot closer. I probably think voter ID can be regulated by Congress.
Okay, John, getting back to the spirit of the law, which is to in part, quote, reduce the influence of big money in politics. What can Congress actually do to reduce money in politics? Because again, this matter has gone before the court time and again, in terms of free speech, in terms of donations.
Well, there's two really interesting questions here. One is, I think, is unresolved, and one I think, as you say, we know about. So, the provision one is: are we going to require more disclosure, right, on who's giving money in politics? That the court has upheld in a case called Buckley versus Valeo, which was the first big federal elections law back in that was one of the post-Watergate reforms, but. You know, there's actually Attorney General Becerra. There's a case at the Supreme Court right now, which is suing California because California is trying to force groups participating in politics to disclose their donations. Right. So there, I think there could be a First Amendment problem if because there are other cases involving the NAACP from the civil rights movement era, which said groups have the right to have anonymous members and anonymous donors. If states are allowed to force disclosure, you're interfering with the right to assembly and the right to petition and the right to speech. Mm-hmm. So I think this court, this Supreme Court, the Roberts Court, based on their tendencies, I think they might be suspicious of forced disclosure in a way that, say, the post-Watergate court was not. But here's the more interesting, this is the more interesting constitutional question is, the other provision that says Congress is going to essentially, they're going to be like the rich anonymous donor in all these requests we're getting these days to give money here, give money there. You'll get a matching. You know, every time I'm watching PBS, they're saying if you give $100, someone will match your donation. So Congress in HR 1 has a provision in there that says if you get a lot of small donations, right, under a certain amount of money, Congress will actually give you as a candidate more money, right? That we're going to, no, we're not just going to match. We're going to, I think, is it some, maybe by 6-1, add more. So this is an interesting thing. Can Congress, right? This is different than the presidential elections where Congress does have a funding system where essentially Congress offers to give both candidates equal amounts of money.
Right.
Can Congress use public money to essentially bias the outcomes of elections by giving money to one side or another? So for example, this reminds me of this is a hypothetical we talk about in law schools. Could Congress pass a law saying only incumbents are allowed to receive congressional funding? Could they say only Republican and Democrats are allowed to receive funding, but not other part? I think this might raise the same issue with this new campaign financing, which is certainly, you know, it's done to support what we call grassroots, right? And to oppose, you know, try to balance out, individual large donors or super PACs and so on. But what if it also has the effect of helping incumbents in office or helping a certain party win? I think that would have a serious constitutional problem.
John, do you think that the House Democrats really expect something to be changed on the money front? Or let me be cynical here for a second. In a very narrow House, which is only about two, I think the vote on this was something like 220 to 210. I mean, it really is a razor thin House. The cynic in me suggests you throw it in there. Why? Because it's going to make AOC and the Bernie Sanders, the squad, that handful of votes you need to get this done. It makes them happy to see that language. So I'm not sure. The cynic in me says I'm not really sure if they really want to go after money, because that affects both sides.
Yeah, it's a weird, you know, you saw a weird lineup like that about Citizens United too. If you remember, Citizens United case to limit donations, particularly to super PACs and so on. And the interesting thing is there, the lineup was ideological, not out of self-interest, because it was the conservatives who wanted to blow out the limits on donations, because we think that's just a restriction on free speech. And the Democrats or liberals want to have far more federal as we're seeing in HR 1, far more federal interference and regulation of politics. But isn't it the case, I think you've mentioned this before too, isn't it the case after Citizens United that it's actually unions who are the ones that give huge amounts of money in politics? Corporations aren't really like giving lots of money to Republican candidates. And so actually the consequences of not limiting campaign donations actually benefits Democrats more than Republicans. Is that not true?
No, that's a correct read. And I'm always curious, unless you're really kind of a fringe member of the House, in other words, you're in the Bernie wing, you're a Democratic socialist, and so you don't take big corporate money for the most part, I don't understand why you want to have a public conversation about this, because everyone, and I mean everyone in Congress, looks bad, John, when you pull up the rock and see what's underneath the rock in terms of donations. One thing, John, that will catch the Supreme Court's attention is another provision in HR 1, which deals with code of ethics of the Supreme Court.
Yes.
So, John, let's discuss code of ethics here. Are they want to make sure that the members don't go into the bathroom anymore on Zoom calls? Are we telling them to make sure they wear pants and dresses when they go to meetings? What does code of ethics mean here, John?
So let me describe what the code of ethics and then why it's become an issue.
By the way, for the record, John, did we ever out which of the nine justices and went to the bathroom during
No, but you know, this is, you know, there are a lot of lawyers who need to take breaks from their work. So there's a lot of speculation on the blogs.
Supreme flush, right?
People actually did sophisticated audio analysis to try to match the background noises of each justice to figure out whose it was. I don't want to insult the commode activity of any of the justices to finger who it is that the balance of experts say it was, but But I will say it was an elderly justice.
Well, you might have known as a conservative or liberal flush Justice John just based on the power of the flush. Let's assume a liberal justice would have a low flush toilet, let's assume. But okay, back to business here. Seriously, code of ethics. What does HR 1 propose for the Supreme Court way of code of ethics?
So it demands that there be a code of ethics on Supreme Court justices.
There's not one right now.
Yeah, there is not one right now. And the reason why, and then the constitutional question is issued, but the reason why is because several of the progressive members of Congress, I think Senator Whitehouse is one of the leaders of this. I think he's having a hearing about this in the within the next week, believe that the Supreme Court is being politicized by big money, as you were saying again, you know, with with the campaign finance issue. And so what they think is that these pools of dark money fund groups, which are, for example, submitting different briefs to the Supreme Court, which are inviting justices to speak at conferences, which are, you know, maybe creating groups that which train Supreme Court clerks to be ideological. So there's this belief out there that the dark money that's influenced, that they claim is influencing our elected politics, is also influencing our justices. So that's why it's important. I actually don't think this is true at all, but this is the claim. The constitutional issue is really interesting because I don't think Congress has the power to tell the justices how to act. This is interesting. The Supreme Court is just created by the Constitution. It's not created by Congress.
Right.
Congress has the power to create the lower courts. And so this is interesting. There is a code of ethics for lower court judges.
Yeah.
There is no code of ethics for Supreme Court justices. I think that has recognized already that distinction, that the Constitution itself creates the court. Congress, Congress can create, you know, dictate as it has how many justices there are.
Right.
But, and so here, this is the kind of thing we worry about in the classroom and academia all the time. If Congress can tell the justices how to act ethically, where does the power stop? Could Congress, for example, say the court has to vote by 6 votes when it strikes down a federal law? How far could Congress go in interfering with the inherent way, the inherent constitutional function of the courts? Mm-hmm. So I think the Supreme Court would probably reject it. But again, it's a question, like we call it first impression. Congress has never tried this one before either. Right. So if HR1 were to pass, it would cause this direct constitutional confrontation between the branches.
Allow me once again to don my cynic's hat and offer the following to you. This is a bill put out by House Democrats. House Democrats still furious that we had a Supreme Court nomination in 2020, furious by the fact that the Federalist Society played an outsized role in the choice of 3 justices under President Trump. Isn't this really, in effect, John, just the House going after the Federalist Society and saying that you people who get together and scheme and give us Supreme Court justices, we're breaking up your party?
Yeah, I think that's the primary political purpose of it.
Right.
Yeah.
So John, again, the constitutional question, can I tell Justice Yu that he cannot give a speech to the Federalist Society?
Yeah. So I don't think that Congress can,
because
Congress can regulate the ethics of Supreme Court justices. So this is interesting. You may remember there was the incident where Justice Scalia went on hunting trips. And he was a justice of rapier wit, but poor aim, because remember he shot someone in the face with a shotgun on these hunting trips. But there was actually a case about, you know, challenging Justice Scalia's right to sit on a case involving Vice President Cheney.
Right.
And one of the interesting questions was, where does the requirement that justices even recuse themselves come from when they have personal attachments to people? And so Scalia actually said, I'm not going to recuse myself from saying Cheney. But, you know, the interesting question raised was, well, you know, where does this idea that everyone agrees with, that justices shouldn't sit on cases where they have interests, come from at all? And it comes from the Supreme Court itself and the idea of the rule of law. But it's not something that I would say Congress can foist on the justices, because the justices are an independent branch.
John, if you start doing recusal, where does that stop? Because you would say Elena Kagan was Solicitor General at one point, right? Mm-hmm. So anything that came up while you were Solicitor General in that administration, any bill, you know, law put forward by that administration or before the court, you have a vested interest. You're biased. You're out. You could go a step further and say any justice appointed by a president who's now before the court, let's say the Supreme Court takes a case on Donald Trump's taxes. Well, you could point to three justices appointed by President Trump and say, well, you got to recuse yourself because you owe him for the job you have right now. So it's just a slippery slope. I don't think they want to go down. But again, and the other thing about this, by the way, I think you pointed this out too, the late RBG. I don't remember anybody saying a peep when she would talk, you know, formerly of the ACLU, when she'd speak to the ACLU. I don't remember anybody saying conflict of interest.
No. I think you're right, Bill. I think it's a politically symbolic proposal, but it's a part of this bill, which has a lot of things that are very attractive to people, that, and they may not be paying attention to these potentially unconstitutional riders that are going along for the trip.
Well, but again, John, I think you're in the business of getting 218 votes in the House. You got to push a lot of buttons and make people happy. So, yeah, you go after big money and, yeah, you go after those evil Republicans on the Supreme Court, the Federalist Society. You just do what it takes to get your majority.
Yeah, you log roll.
Exactly. You do your log roll, and it's not pretty. Yeah. And credit to you for reading this, by the way. You have a more cast iron stomach than I do. But here's the thing about H.R. 1. As much as we've talked about this, John, it may never see the light of day. Why? It did pass the House on a majority vote. It could pass the Senate on a straight line 51-50 vote. That's if Joe Manchin goes along with it. But to get to that 51-50 vote, John, it has to survive a Senate filibuster. And I don't think you're going to get 60 votes to move this thing forward, which then begs this question of killing the filibuster in the Senate altogether. So, John, constitutionally, can they kill a filibuster?
Yeah, I think so, although I doubt they would for this bill. But the filibuster is not in the Constitution. It is a self-imposed rule by the Senate on itself. This is what used to be called the nuclear option, but it's not so nuclear. There's been more uses of the nuclear option now than there have been of nuclear weapons in world history. Right. So the idea is that the Senate, like the House, works by principal majority, although the Constitution doesn't actually state that, but we always assume it. And so the Senate creates restrictions on its own ability to decide everything by majority vote. And the filibuster is just one aspect of that. You could say the committee system is an aspect of that too. Reconciliation is an effort. It was a repeal essentially of filibuster, the filibuster rule for, but you know, people who are critical of it, and I think they're quite right, say that the Senate cannot, a simple majority of the Senate cannot subject the rest of the Senate to a supermajority rule.
Right. So I'm glad you raised that point, John, because I now want you to get into that guessing game. What did the founding fathers have in mind? But one thing that stands out, John, and this is where it gets tricky to me when we talk about the majority in the Senate is, yes, it's 100 senators, John, but it's 100 senators, one third of which are chosen in, you know, different cycles. So it's not like you have a Senate, John, which everybody is up for election at the same time. So you can say a 52-48 Senate is a direct reflection of the American people. No, it's a function of the last three elections. So I think when you start talking about majority, hence will of the people, it's not so clear the Senate really is that case.
Oh, yeah. I quite agree. If you want to talk about what the founders thought, I mean, they specifically designed the Senate to slow things down. There's a famous quote by Jefferson, where... they were asked, why is there a Senate? And so I think President Washington, or it was Thomas Jefferson, was drinking a cup of tea in a saucer. And he said, well, the tea's too hot. And then so you have to pour it into the saucer and let it cool. I guess back in the 18th century, people would drink tea out of the saucers. That sounds kind of weird to me. But so Washington said, that's what the Senate does. The Senate is like the saucer in the cup of tea. It allows the tea to cool. You're right. The Senate itself, just by the, you know, the staggered terms, also just the representation of the Senate is anti-majoritarian. Right. You could say, I think, people say, who are upset about the filibuster, say, look, something as small as 16% of the country's population, if it banded together and all used the filibuster, could stop all legislation. But that's true of the Senate as a whole. You know, the Senate is designed to represent the states, not represent the majority of the country. So the filibuster rule, to me, is just an amplification of the Senate's original nature, which is to slow things down for deliberation and ultimately represent the interests of the states. That's right. Why, when you ask, you know, is it constitutional? It's, you know, it's a hard thing for me to imagine, although this is something that you see right now, particularly hard to imagine smaller states wanting to give up the filibuster. This is an interesting reflection of how much partisanship matters now, right. Is that you have, I think, smaller states, though Democrat, who are supporting getting rid of the filibuster, which is strange. It's really much against their institutional interests.
It is. You mentioned, John, an email correspondence we had that you got caught up in filibuster conversations back in the day when you're working in Washington. What did you exactly talk about back then? This would have been back when, and keep in mind, this changes back and forth. Republicans complain about the filibuster when Democrats run the show and, you know, so on and so forth.
Oh, yeah, this is not a partisan thing. It's a who happens to be in power thing.
Whose ox is getting gored.
Yeah, right. Yeah, because back in the 2000s, you know, back when I was in the government, Democrats used the filibuster to try to stop President Bush, George W. Bush, from appointing judges. And they actually successfully did filibuster several appeals judges, and there had to be a compromise worked out.
Speaking of vicious cycles, is what led Harry Reid to change the rules of the Senate, which then backfired when Mitch McConnell used it. And again,
I think that, you know, the interesting thing, this is when the nuclear option phrase comes from, because the Republicans back then, and this started around 2003, 2002, started saying, well, we're, you know, because then the Republicans had the majority of the Senate after the 2002 elections. And so they said, well, and it was not a large majority. And they said, well, we're going to get rid of the filibuster. We're going to use the nuclear option. And actually, I thought that was a bad idea, that it's actually a good idea for the Senate not to be just like the House, as just a matter of constitutional function. And so even though the Senate itself already is not representative of the majority of the population, the Senate's purpose is to be deliberative and slower, and really to protect federalism. So this is why I mentioned, I would think this would be an issue where you really would see senators not want to get rid of the filibuster. If the purpose of the Senate is to protect the prerogatives of the states in our system, then I would think they would not want to rush to enact a bill, which H.R. 1, which is an enormous expansion of federalism. You know, I often said to my liberal friends after the November 4th election, you guys should love federalism now in elections, because what you should have seen is that the way our system decentralizes elections makes it very difficult for anyone to really tamper with the system as a whole, to take it over, right? If elections were centralized in Washington, D.C., President Trump's ability to interfere with the election would have been much greater than having it dispersed through 50 states. And I worry that H.R. 1 represents that kind of federalization of elections and would defeat the decentralized nature of our electoral system, which is created by our Constitution. So that's why I think if the senators are really, you know, keeping an eye out for the purpose of even having a Senate to defend the rights of the states, they should want to have a filibuster, especially for laws like this one.
So, John, you mentioned small state senators, and that would include Joe Manchin from West Virginia, who is arguably one of the most powerful men in Washington right now, because depending on how he wets his finger and determines the wind is blowing, he can make things happen in the Senate or make things not happen, because he is the trickiest and 50th vote to get something to where Kamala Harris can break the tie. And he is very confusing to read on the filibuster, John. He said right after the election, in no uncertain terms, he did not want to take away the filibuster, but he was on Fox News the other day with Brett Baer, and there was kind of a crack here. And he wasn't as adamant as he was. And some people think that he might be looking for sort of a halfway solution where you can filibuster on some things, but you can't filibuster on others. So again, constitutionally, John, how could the Senate set up a system where, okay, I can filibuster a fiscal bill, but I can't filibuster a judicial nomination, let's say?
Well, Manchin, if that's the route he wants to go, which is sort of cleaving off different kinds of issues that are no longer subject to the filibuster.
He wants to have it both ways, John. He wants to not be the jerk in the room and just say no to everything. He wants his party to do things. He also doesn't want to get, you know, run out on a rail in his home state for letting his party do everything, because the party's more to the left of his constituents. So he maybe looking, it's sort of like that 50s game, John, where you get on board, there'd be like a little bongo drum underneath, you'd go back and forth on it. And I think he's trying to do that on the filibuster, maybe saying we'll do kind of a conditional halfway filibuster, if you will.
Yeah. So there's two ways you could do it. One, which the Senate has been doing for decades now, is to just sort of identify certain subjects which just aren't going to be subject to the filibuster anymore. Remember, the filibuster used to be 2/3, not 60, and it used to apply pretty much to everything. So the reconciliation process, which was used to pass the COVID bill, which says basically budget fiscal bills are not subject to the filibuster, right? Mm-hmm. That's cleaving it off. The as you mentioned, Harry Reid cleaving off appellate lower court judges,
right,
and then Mitch McConnell cleaving off Supreme Court justices is another example of that. So you could see, but it's hard for me to see Manchin saying, okay, bills having to do with the elections or the electoral system are no longer subject to the filibuster. You'd be like, mm-hmm, well, why is that? There's no like principle behind that the way there is between legislation and say appointments. Now, the other thing he could do, which is what I thought he was proposing, was to make the exercise of the filibuster more difficult. Mm-hmm. So the roots of the filibuster come from the idea that there's no real restriction on how long a senator is allowed to speak for. Sometimes that seems to be a qualification for the job, is that they can talk endlessly about any subject. So if the filibuster is really comes from the idea any senator can talk for as long as they want, mm-hmm, then what Manchin, and so the filibuster as it works now, is just basically the threat of that, right? Someone, mm-hmm, senator says, I'm going to filibuster this bill. And so they take a vote to find out, which is called cloture, right? They try to find out whether there are actually 60 senators who would say, right, no, we're going to shut off debate. But they don't really go through that because just raising the threat itself is enough. But and this is what happened back in the Bush years on the judicial nominations question, mm-hmm, was the Republicans actually said, okay, we're going to actually force you to keep debating. I mean, we're going, right, to make you live up. It's not just a threat. And so they actually did it round the clock, I think, for several days. And there were senators, you know, sleeping in the cloakroom or the little rooms where the Republicans and Democrats each have one off the floor of the Senate. So that's what I thought I heard Manchin said. He said he wanted to make it more painful to use the filibuster. So he might actually say, maybe what we should do is actually, if the Republicans want to filibuster, then make them stand up and talk continuously,
right,
and never let debate end if they really, which they'll do, right? But it'll be a nice spectacle. And maybe Manchin can say, look, I imposed a little bit of pain on the Republicans. Now, I will say, back in the 2000s, when this happened, when the Republicans forced the Democrats to do it, eventually there was a compromise, mm-hmm, reached. And maybe, although I don't know if this, you know, pays off for Democrats, because if you're filibustering, that means the Senate can't go to any other business. Correct. So if Manchin says, I'm going to force McConnell and all those Republicans to stand up in the floor of the Senate and talk for 3 days in a row, including the nights, there's no breaks. Mm-hmm. That means the Senate can't pass any other legislation. They can't vote on any other nominations. They're just, right, they're paralyzed.
Yeah, but John, Ted Cruz gets to read Dr. Seuss again.
Not anymore.
Oh, no.
Only certain Dr. Seuss books, not all of them.
Not in Ted Cruz's America. It's still there. Final topic, John. I sure appreciate your time today. It's been almost 3 weeks now since the Supreme Court, in theory at least, put the final nail in the coffin as to disputes over the 2020 election. They rejected challenges filed by President Trump and his allies in regards to results in Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. Decide not to even hear the cases, which I guess was no surprise. Question one, John, does this mean it's over at long last? But then second, John, the question of legacy, what do we know now about election challenges in the Supreme Court based on what happened since the November election?
I actually thought it was unwise for the court not to take the case. And you may remember Justice Thomas wrote a dissent signed by, I think, Justice Alito and Justice Gorsuch, saying you should take the case. And the reason why goes to your question, which is, even though the 2020 election is over, the constitutional question, which allowed Trump to raise all these doubts, is still unresolved. And so Thomas's point, actually, I thought was a good one, which was, we can decide that issue now, and it won't affect the election, and it won't be wrapped up in partisan politics. Mm-hmm. If the court doesn't decide it now, then that just means you're waiting for another 4 years or 8 years when it becomes important again, And then you're going to, the court's going to have to wade in when it actually could make a difference, like it did in Bush versus Gore. The constitutional question being, does the state legislature, as it says in the Constitution, have the final say on all the right, time, place, and manner, the way presidential electors are chosen, or can state courts and state governors change them, as happened in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and so on? That question is unresolved. And that was really the core constitutional question out of the 2020 elections. Now, just it didn't matter in terms of because of the margins that President Biden won by in those states like Pennsylvania and Nevada and Wisconsin. But what Justice Thomas was saying is, well, yeah, but you are letting the time bomb keep ticking. You know it's a time bomb, and you didn't turn it off when you have the chance.
Okay, you're not privy to their inside thinking, John, but what's your sense as to why they don't want to take up the cases? Is it they just would prefer to kick this down the road? Are they still traumatized by Bush v. Gore? What's exactly driving the court here?
I think this is really a demonstration of the continuing influence of Chief Justice Roberts. So people have been speculating, oh, now that Amy Coney Barrett and Brett Kavanaugh are on the court, it's not really going to be the Roberts court anymore. And, you know, Roberts has been criticized by both sides, both conservatives and liberals, for trying to keep the court out of politics, even when the court issues decisions which don't seem to make a lot of sense. But you can see what he's been doing over and over again is just try to evade and avoid politically controversial issues whenever he can. And he's basically said that's his goal because he wants to reduce the temperature. And I think that's what he did here. Especially after the attack on the Capitol, you would think anything having to do with the 2020 election is still a hot potato. And so here's one way you can see it is not only did Amy Coney Barrett not vote to take the case, but Brett Kavanaugh voted not to take the case, which is amazing because you may remember these cases are mostly out of Pennsylvania. And this, when the cases were going forward before earlier, Kavanaugh actually voted to say that the court may well should take the case and was going along with the other conservatives to say, we're going to watch Pennsylvania closely. This was the provision where the Pennsylvania court said, we're going to allow ballots to come in after election day, even though prohibited by state law. So Kavanaugh flipped his vote on whether to take this issue. And people have not really noticed this. I think that's really that shows still that Roberts really is a very persuasive, powerful Chief Justice.
How does that work inside the court, John, in terms of justices don't lobby other justices, do they?
Oh, you poor naive guy. You love politics so much, but you got to think there's some pure place where politics doesn't happen.
No, I'm just
Supreme Court. Oh, no, they lobby all the time. They just don't call it lobbying. They call it persuasion and discussion.
So how does that work then between the new kid on the court in Kavanaugh and the chief? Yeah. Does the new kid just have the smarts to listen to what the chief is saying and think this is what the chief wants?
Here's something that's, you know, this is very, I think people don't realize it, but the Supreme Court is, I think, of the three great branches of our government, is the one where the actual principals do most of their own work. Right? So the justices only have a staff of four people.
Right.
You know, Diane Feinstein probably has a staff of 50, 60, right, as senator. And of course, a cabinet member has hundreds or thousands.
Right. So whereas she'll read a statement at a committee hearing, someone's written that for her, the justice writes his or her opinion.
Well, they use the clerks to help draft them.
Right.
But there's only four of them. And so, you know, but it's even before then. So they're not only that, but they're also on the same floor of a small building.
Right.
And so the justices can just walk two doors down from their own office and go and talk to the other justices.
Right.
And then there's a huge blizzard of emails and memos where they explicitly lobby. So Justice O'Connor was quite the master of this. She would, so the way it worked, and this is, here's another example of how there's no staff and there's lobbying, is when they hear case, right, there's oral argument, they hear case, and then they repair to the justices' conference room. No staff are allowed in there, only the nine justices. And they talk about the case and they vote on how they're going to, you know, how it's going to come out. And the chief justice assigns the opinion to the, in the majority, when he's in the majority. Then they circulate an opinion. That's when the real lobbying goes on, because someone like Justice O'Connor would say, I'll join your opinion. And you can see this in the archives now. You know, Justice O'Connor or Justice Brennan was also very good at this. They would say, I'll join your opinion, but you got to do these 10 things for me. And they would write out, it's not like the Senate or the House. They would say, you have to make these 10 changes. And they would write out a long letter to each other and say, but if you do that, you have my vote. That's lobbying, isn't it? So there's a lot of that goes on. So I think what I would say 95% probably what happened is that Chief Justice Roberts walked over to Justice Kavanaugh's office and walked over to Amy Coney Barrett's office and said, you know, trust me, you guys are new. This is politically a disaster for us to take these cases. It's over. What's the point? Let's just get it behind us and focus on the important issues. Let me take care of the politics. Let me take the heat from politicians. I'll protect the institution of the court. And by keeping us out of partisan politics, we can sit down and really decide on Roe versus Wade.
Okay, but John, but final question, John, let's say it's 2024, November 2024, and a new president has won the election, but he or she has won the election in a very narrow way. They may have won by a large popular vote margin, but they've won by enough electoral votes to make this contentious. And then if you can flip electoral votes in four or five states, as we saw in 2020, the outcome could change. And not that many votes in those states decides the election. So the loser will quickly become a sore loser, and the loser side will quickly want to go to court. So, John, what's really kind of preventing us from going down the same road in 2024? And if we do end up in this same situation in 2024, where the losing side is litigating, doesn't the court have to act?
No, you're exactly right, Bill. Nothing stops it. In fact, you could say that one of the lessons of 2020 is that, yes, these courts are going to be open for these. And that the problem with Trump is that he didn't have a real case. But courts all around the country actually heard the cases. Trump just couldn't provide the facts. Well, but suppose you're right, like, suppose you get a Bush versus Gore situation where you actually do have real facts, where you actually say, you know, the court's decision will make a difference. There's enough votes at stake right. to swing this state, and that state swings the election. One thing 2020 showed was that Bush versus Gore was not a one-off, right. that the courts are open to these challenges. And that's why I think Thomas was right about this, was he was saying, let's decide the legal issues now before right. that happens, so that no one will accuse us in the future of, you know, deciding this question, can state legislatures be overridden by governors and state courts because they think we want Republicans or Democrats to win. I think that was a big misstep by the court.
There is one way to avoid this, John, and that's to abolish the Electoral College. But again, is it constitutional?
Well, let me pitch one of my articles.
I'm close on this.
I wrote a law review article 3 years ago. I can, you know, trying to explain why the framers created the Electoral College. I wrote something for Hoover about it. Mm-hmm. So this is very interesting. The Electoral College is often criticized as this very Rube Goldberg-esque institution. But I actually think there's a lot of reasons the founders had, which were good ones, to create something like the Electoral. Primarily, they didn't want Congress to pick the president because that would create a parliamentary system.
Right.
But they also didn't want to have a direct popular vote because they're afraid of demagogues. So they had to come up with some kind of compromise in between.
Right.
And the Electoral College generally has worked for most of our history. It just has trouble when it's really, really close. Let me describe this. This is a very interesting constitutional point. Bill, you've been asking me, like, I think this might be the 10th question you've asked me, for which I have to say nobody really knows because it's unprecedented. But there's something called the National Popular Vote Initiative out there.
Yes.
Where, this is very clever, right? Because the state...
And this is if a majority of states representing 270 electoral votes agree that will abide by their popular vote. And that's the election.
Yeah, so right. The interesting thing, the constitutional mechanism is, I think, actually going back to the founders, which is the Constitution actually says the state legislatures
right.
decide how to pick the electors. It's just that every state until this initiative have chosen to follow by popular vote. But right, the state legislature could always take that back. The Supreme Court has said this, can take that power back and pick the electors itself. And that's what's going to happen with this initiative. 270, the states representing 270 electoral votes say, we don't care who votes for who in our state. We're going to give all our electoral votes to whoever wins the national majority vote. The problem, now here's the constitutional problem, is that and this makes sense, it has to work this way. It has to be an agreement among the states, right? Because right. It can be tricky. You'd say, okay, I'm not going to do it this time. Like Texas could say, ah, you suckers, you all voted for Ted Cruz or whatever, but I'm, you know, we're going to go with our national vote. I mean, our popular vote, not our electoral vote this time. Ha ha, you guys follow the initiative. We're breaking our word. Yep. So the initiative to work has to be an agreement between the states. Now, these agreements between the states are called compacts in the Constitution, and they're unconstitutional unless Congress approves them. So here's the thing. This is where it goes back on you, Bill. So suppose 270 electoral votes, I mean, the states representing those states do adopt the initiative. I think they're around 200 right now.
Yes.
So suppose enough states do get to 270 votes. Then they're going to have to take that compact and submit it to Congress for approval.
Right.
It'll get filibustered. Do you think this is a case where the senators will overcome the filibuster to get rid of the Electoral College? Mm-hmm. I don't know. This is another example where the Electoral College does give small states some advantage. And it's the only reason presidential candidates show up in a lot of states to campaign is because of the Electoral College. Would the senators actually vote for partisan reasons in a way that will damage the long-term interests of their states?
Right.
I would hope not, but given the way things are lining up on HR1, maybe they would.
Well, it's probably a 2025 issue, John, because right now the system worked for the Democrats. They won by 7 million votes in the popular election, and they won the Electoral College. I think it was, 306 to 232, if I'm not mistaken. So the system worked. But let's say they lose in 2024, John, and again win by 7 million popular votes, but they lose 271 to 267 in the Electoral College, then yes, you're gonna get this complaint. And yes, somebody's going to come forward with it. But, you know, again, the question is going to be the balance of power in Washington, what in Congress. And that's what's fascinating with all these things, John, how much little differences make in the harsh system. I've had people, you know, screaming at me for the past week about these bills being produced in Congress, the stimulus package and HR1 now. And at this point that if not for a few thousand votes in Georgia in November, there would not have been a second runoff. There would be 51 Republican senators. It'd be a very different world.
Yeah, that's right.
Just as if you want to look in California, I was doing a podcast the other day, John, with an author of a book on Kamala Harris. She kind of squeaked by when she ran for attorney general in California in 2010. Yeah. She loses that election. She may not be where she is today. So, you know, elections matter, to use that very tired cliche.
That's no elections do matter. But I just want to remind our, you know, our liberal friends that, you know, they used to like federalism too. You know, all of these things you've asked me about, the COVID bill, HR1, getting rid of the filibuster, getting rid of the Electoral College, right? They're all designed to expand national power at the expense of the states and decentralized government. And they should remember in the George W. Bush years and the Donald Trump years, it was our liberal friends who retreated, right, to the ramparts of the states to oppose what those administrations they didn't like were doing. And so it's always short-term thinking, I think, to just think, oh, centralizing everything, you know, is your friend because you think you're going to be in political power and win every national election from now on.
Okay. John, let's wrap up the podcast. I do have a question for you. There was a very awful story on the wires today about a law professor at Georgetown who was on a Zoom call. And I think it was a woman, not a man, but at the end of the Zoom call, she was still on a Zoom call. And she started going off in a tirade about Black students in her class, about how they don't pay attention. They don't learn suitably. Yeah, really. Oh, it's just a very, very bad moment for the professor, obviously, and for Georgetown. A question. I'm kind of curious, with California starting to ease restrictions now on life, and if it's changed at all your teaching at Berkeley, and just a quick thought or two from you, John, and just what it's been like to teach, especially law classes, remotely.
I think it's a it really interferes. I think this Zoom world really interferes with the kind of teaching we do in law school. And I would say the kind of teaching you do in graduate schools.
Yeah.
Because we don't really lecture. So I could see, and this could be go to the future of higher education, its cost structure. If you've got 1,000 or 500 students in the classroom, I don't see why they all have to be there. You know, if you're taking Intro to American Politics, you know, I'd say 80% of the first 80% of the class is probably just a straight read lecture, and then you might have some questions afterwards. Mm-hmm. The Zoom world seems particularly appropriate for that and could reduce costs of higher education enormously. Mm-hmm. But when you get to seminars and law school style classes where a lot of it is like what we've been doing on the podcast. So, you know, you're sitting there saying, okay, enough of your rhetoric. Let's get to the tough questions. I want to hear yes or no.
Right.
You know, that's hard. I find that hard to do on Zoom. And so I think the quality of the education, and also let me say the second thing is, I don't know whether this is because of Zoom or it's just other trends. You are seeing more and more of these claims of inappropriate statements, inappropriate conduct by teachers and students and what they say. That really worries me. I don't know if Zoom contributes to that in some way. Maybe people lose their sense of decorum or whatever it is.
That's what people are making comments in chat functions.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and then you're seeing other people get offended and so on. I think people are going to be worried about the things they say in class are going to be used against them someday in the future. All of that is going to harm the educational enterprise.
Yeah.
I think, you know, people should be able to say what they want in class. But you are seeing more and more restrictions, I think, on free speech in the classroom. And I think that's also harming education. So Berkeley, I think like a lot of universities is planning to reopen in August for in-person classes. But I wonder, and it goes to your question, I wonder whether the habits we've learned in Zoom are going to spill over and it's never going to be the same again, especially with this kind of heightened sensitivity. This worried about being offensive, you know, the less candor and argument you get in class, the less students are going to learn.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one casualty of COVID is we've not been able to see you on the Stanford campus for some time. So I want your promise right now, my friend, when we do open up, if and ever we open up, you come over and we'll hang out. Okay.
There's a McDonald's on University Avenue, right? When you drive over the 101. So I'll pick up the McDonald's.
We're not doing McDonald's. We're going to go to Shake Shack when they bring back the Korean chicken sandwich.
Oh, I got to try that. Yeah, we don't have Shake Shack over here. I'm eager. I hate to be snobbish about it. I'm not happy anytime there's a Korean flavor in anything, but I'm sure it's going to be like, you know, eating American versions of hamburgers in Asia. It's just going to seem fake.
Okay, our listeners are now thinking, oh my God, here they go on fast food. So time for us to get off, John, but really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for always. You just are terrific at explaining very complicated legal issues.
Thanks. Great to be with you again, Bill.
You've been listening to Matters of Policy and Politics, a Hoover Institution podcast devoted to governance and balance of power here in America and around the world. If you've been enjoying this podcast, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word. Get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, sign up for the Daily Report, which delivers the best work of John Yoo and his Hoover colleagues straight to your inbox weekdays. And getting signed up for that is also easy. Once again, go to that Publications tab, and it'll be staring at you smack dab. So the Hoover Daily Report. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. John Yoo, still not on Twitter. Don't go looking for him on Twitter. You'll find a lot of John Yoos, but they're not the real deal. But you can hear John on the Hoover Institution's Pacific Century podcast. We mentioned at the top of the broadcast. And again, go check out his book, Defender in Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power. I guess that fight kind of ended early, didn't it, John?
You never know. He might be back.
It was entertaining while it lasted. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Matters of Policy and Politics. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.